Okay, Boker Tov, good morning, everyone. Welcome back for this week's edition, this week's Learning Insights into the Weekly Parsha, Parshas Mishpatim. For those of you who'd like to follow along with us, it's page 416, page 417 in the English, in the Art Scroll, Blue Stone Chumashim. Our learning this morning has been generously sponsored by our dear friends Jeffrey and Carla Klein in commemoration of the Yahrzeit of Carla's beloved father, Philip Lewin. His neshama should have an aliyah, and in the merit and the schus of us learning Torah together, it should be a merit for the entire family. Thank you so much for your generosity. Thank you so much for your sponsorship. So I'd like to begin our learning this morning by sharing with you a story about a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Mordechai Green. Now, this Rabbi Mordechai Green moved to Hamilton, Ontario in 1958, where he ended up serving as the Rav for 44 years. Now, when he came as a young man, he was 24 years old, and the shul, the synagogue, was dwindling, and there wasn't much going on in the neighborhood. It was just very quiet. It was a lot of potential. It was a lot of opportunity, but it wasn't a bustling community, a metropolis. He knew that in order for an Orthodox shul to succeed, so he felt that it was necessary to move and to rebuild in a nicer neighborhood in Hamilton. But there was a problem. He had no money. He had no way and wherewithal to do so. And he realized that the way that the community is going to have its success would be, in fact, if they were able to do that. So he went to the local branch of Royal Bank, which at the time was one of the largest banks in Canada. And he made an appointment and he sat down with the vice president of the bank, an Episcopalian by the name of Mr. Amy, A-M-Y. And he asked him for a loan. So he said, how much do you want a loan for? He says, I need a loan for $500,000, $500,000. So the vice president, he like looks at him and he laughs at him. He's like, are you serious? Do you have anyone who's going to be the personal guarantor? Anybody's going to back up the loan? Somebody's going to co-sign the loan? Are you serious? So the rabbi said, no. And the bank manager said, if you don't have anybody to co-sign on the loan and you don't have, you know, anybody who's going to be willing to be a personal guarantor, their property, their assets, I'm sorry, how can I give you a loan? And how can I give you a loan of that exorbitant, huge amount of money? So he says, have a nice day, I'm sorry. So the rabbi gets up and he turns to leave. And he's, you know, taking leave of this Mr. Amy. He says, I'm just curious, but what do you need $500,000 for? Like, I mean, you ask for a loan and you tell me it's an important cause and you tell me it's an important purpose, but like, what do you need the money for? So the rabbi says to him, the loan that I need, the money is to build a synagogue. A synagogue? A shul? He says, what kind of synagogue? He says, an Orthodox synagogue. So then Mr. Amy says, okay, then sit down. Calls him back to the table. He says, okay, I'm willing to help you. He says, you're willing to help me? So the rabbi is curious. He says, why do you want to help me? You know, you just told me that, you know, it's an exorbitant amount of money. There's nobody to co-sign on the loan. You know, there's no way I'm going to be able to help you. But now you tell me to sit back down and now you're willing to help me. So I'll tell you, the vice president says, so I have a story. He says, when I was a little boy, when I was but a child, I was orphaned at a young age. And he said that my mother had five children, including me, and no source of income. She was unemployed. And we were living in a town in a place called Timmins, Ontario. And my mother walked into the general store, you know, in the town there one day. And she was looking at the price tags on the food and on the clothing. You know, those stores had everything in those days, one of these general stores. And my mother, she was looking at the price tags. Now, the owner of the general store came over and said to my mother, he says, I heard what happened to you, and I heard what happened to your husband. I understand you're taking care of small children. I understand that you don't have a job. Don't worry about the cost. I see that you're looking at the prices. I see that, you know, you have anguish and pain in your eyes. You're probably concerned and wondering that there's no way you're going to be able to clothe these children, clothe yourself with the minimal amount of funds that you have. So take the clothing that you need for your children. Take the food that you need for your children. And he said, as long as I own this store, your family will be taken care of. So this is the story this vice president tells him. Now, that man was an Orthodox Jew. And this is the first opportunity I have had in my whole life to repay his kindness. Because that Orthodox Jew who owned the general store was kind to my mother and kind to our family and gave us in our time of need. I never had met an Orthodox Jew before, let alone somebody who was so kind and so generous and so willing to, through his sensitivity to give. Says, I never met an Orthodox Jew before. And this Orthodox Jew now that man was the first Orthodox Jew, and this is the first opportunity I have to repay his kindness. So decades later, that one Jew, obviously we know is long gone. That man is in the Olam HaEmes, is in the world of truth, in the Olam Haba. And because of that one chesed, because of that one generosity, that was clearly, at least in that moment, not repaid to him. It wasn't necessarily that he got his money back. He didn't even necessarily know who those people were. That the chesed, the kindness, the example, the role model, the way he lived his life, not necessarily realizing that because of the kippah, the yarmulke that's on his head, and that that he was identified as an Orthodox Jew, what that would do, that decades ago, where this fellow lived, that there is now a massive, beautiful synagogue, a beautiful shul, a yeshiva, a mikvah, thousands of Jewish children who have received an education there over the years because of the generosity that this father, all right, shows to this man, shows to this woman and to these children. And now here's this Rabbi Green, and now he asks for a loan. He wants to build this community. Now this Mr. Amy says, I'm going to help you. I'm going to give you the loan. And with this money, you're going to go build your shul, your synagogue, your community, your yeshiva, your mikvah, so on and so forth. And as they say, the rest is history. It's a stunning example of the so many that exist, of how people who live their lives with a sense of realizing that they are people of morals, people of values, people of ethics. It's not that they know that the cameras are rolling. It's not that they realize that they're going to be a spotlight in an upcoming article in a magazine, or they're going to be interviewed in a major way at a major news network. They're just ordinary people who are far from ordinary. They're extraordinary. They're ordinary people who live their lives in a way that reflect the values that they live. They don't just say it, but they live it. And what happens when you live your life in such a way is that you never realize to what extent that influence can be on other people. The influence of positivity, the positivity that it then spirals into another place, into another place. As we say, as the Mishnah teaches us in Ethics of Our Fathers and Perkei Avos, mitzvah goreres mitzvah, that one good deed, one action, one mitzvah, it then culminates into an opportunity and a fulfillment of another good deed, of another mitzvah. So there's one opportunity after another opportunity. By just living our lives, we connect ourselves to other people, and maybe people that will have never an opportunity to know their names, know who they are, know how we influence them, and know what kind of consequences for the world ultimately they have. Rahman al-Aslan lo aleinu, the reverse, unfortunately, is likewise true as well. We don't realize that if we speak disparagingly about other people, about institutions, about restaurants, about anything for that matter, we don't realize that there are people that are listening, that there are others that are watching, and that the influence of others, organic as it may be, but despite the fact that others are watching, people are influenced by what you do, by good or by bad. So we understand that there's a connection. There is a kinetic connection that exists between people, between institutions, and there's a longevity that happens as a result of how it is that I act today without realizing the consequences for our focus this morning in the positive sense of the consequences as they exist for tomorrow. And this, of course, is how our parsha this morning begins. Ve'ela ha-mishpatim, the vav ha-chibor, the letter vav, the singular os, the letter vav. The gematria, of course, is 6, but the number 6 and the connection of what the vav is, ve'ele ha-mishpatim. What is ve'ele ha-mishpatim? And these are the chukim, these are the ordinances, and these are the laws. Let's just simply list the ones that are mentioned in Parshas Mishpatim. So, of course, we understand from our commentaries that the vav is what we call the vav ha-chibor. The vav is the connector. As my deed connects to other people knowingly or unknowingly, there's a connection between Parshas Mishpatim and that which came previous. What comes previous is last week's Parsha, Parshas Yisro. And Parshas Yisro, of course, is the seminal event, Mamad Har Sinai, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, the utterances that not just makes us a people, but makes us a people with a purpose, a people with a book, a doctrine, a Torah, HaKadosha, that is the neshama, that is the heart, that is the soul, that fills the body with purpose, with meaning, that is the holy conch, kavayochol, that is the law for which we live our lives, that governs, that helps dictate, that helps, of course, inspire, and animates not only our past and not our future only, but of course our present as well. So the connection of what was in last week's parsha, all of the laws and all of the thunder, the lightning, the drama of Mamad Har Sinai, the drama of that Mamad Har Sinai now continues in Parshas Mishpatim, and with the nuances and even more particulars, and the dinim, the laws, as they relate to business dealings, as they relate to Ben Adam L'Chavero issues between us, interpersonal relationships, and other, our mankind, our fellow man. So we have to understand that those great magnanimous utterances that took place at Mamad Har Sinai, so those are connected to the seemingly monotonous, what others would wrongly suppose and conclude are less significant, but these are no less significant laws in our parsha, the Vav HaChibor, the connection between the Decalogue Parsha and Parshas Mishpatim. Parshas Yisro and Parshas Mishpatim are intrinsically interwoven with each other. But this Vav, as we understand, as a connector, and the connections that we make and the influences that we have play significantly not only at the beginning of our Parsha, but also likewise at the end of our Parsha. We'll see that towards the end of our Parsha, we read that after Moshe Rabbeinu communicated to the people all of the series of laws that he had heard from the Ribbono Shel Olam b'chavodo uva'atzmo, so he's summoned by the Ribbono Shel Olam another time, and as he's summoned by the Ribbono Shel Olam, he's told to return to the har, to the mountaintop, and he's told that when he comes to the mountaintop, he's going to receive the rest of the dinim, the rest of the laws. The pasuk says, "Vayomer Hashem el Moshe," God says to Moses, "Ale elai hahara, come up to me to the mountain, v'heyesham, and you should remain there. V'etna l'chos luchos, and you should know while you're up here, I am going to, while you're here, give you the stone tablets, the luchos, ha'even, v'ha'torah, v'ha'mitzvah asher kosavti l'hirosam, the stone tablets, the law, the commandments that I have written to instruct them. This is what you shall do upon your return." And then the Torah tells us in the very next pasuk, "Vayakam," and this word "Vayakam" is going to be our significant focus this morning, but not just the word "kum" and "Vayakam" or "Yakam," but "Vayakam" with the vav hachibor, the connection between Moshe ascending to the mountain to receive the tablets, and then what that is going to mean for him, what that's going to mean for Yehoshua, what that's going to mean for the Jewish people, what that's going to mean for us. Pasuk says, "Vayaka Moshe v'Yehoshua." So Moses and Joshua, Misharso, his trusted servant, "Vaya'al Moshe el har ha'elukim." So it was Moshe and Yehoshua. They arose, they got up, and Moshe ascends to the mountain of God. Now it seems as if they're both going to ascend, and then at the end of the verse is that only Moshe ascends. So we're going to study this pasuk, this verse, a little bit more in depth. "Vayaka Moshe v'Yehoshua misharso," Moshe and his attendant, Joshua, Yehoshua, they arose. And again, Perek Chav Dalet, Pasuk Yud Gimel, chapter 24, verse 13, Moses then ascended to the top of Mount Sinai, and this is where we are left. Now Rashi explains the curiosity of why it's Moshe Rabbeinu ascends and Yehoshua doesn't ascend. So Rashi explains that Yehoshua escorted his Rebbe. He escorts his teacher. You know, you have a Rebbe, you have a prominent person. You escort, you show honor, you show deference, you show kavod. So Yehoshua teaches us this by escorting his Rebbe, his teacher Moshe Rabbeinu, to the point beyond which he was not permitted to be. Meaning he came to a certain point and no longer. "Vayokam Moshe v'Yehoshua misharso." So Rashi says, I do not know what business Yehoshua had here. But I would say, he says, "Va'omer ani shahaya hatalmid melavi l'rav ad mokum hagabalas hachayim yahar." The Rashi says that it seems to be that the disciple, that the Talmud, that the student, Yehoshua, Joshua, he escorts his mentor, he escorts Moshe, he escorts Moses until the place of the limits of the boundaries of the mountain, right? Because we understood from last week's parasha, there was hagbala, there was a boundary that was set, and the people were not permitted to go past a certain boundary. And if they did, they would die. And so it seems that he was only able to perceive and to achieve a place on the mountain only up until a certain point. And he's only permitted to go there, not past that point. And it was from there that Misham Yalo Moshe Levado El Harha Elokim, Rashi says. It must be from that point on, after he was escorted to Moshe Rabbeinu, then he goes alone up and ascends the Har Hashem, the Har Elokim. And he ascends the mountain of God. And as Rashi says, Yeshua not to Shamaholo. Omis Akiv Sham Kol Arbaim Yom. You know what happened? Yeshua, he pitches his tent and he waits there for 40 days for Moshe Rabbeinu to come back, to come down. Kishirid Moshe, V'yishma Yoshua's Kol Ha'am B'ra'os. Again, the psukim substantiate this. So it's not that just he went with him and he goes with him. But then at a certain point, he stops. And Rashi explains this query, this curiosity. He stops. And at a certain point, only it is that Moshe Rabbeinu continues to ascend because it was a Hagbola. There was a boundary. There was a border. You can go up until this point and no further. And Yoshua, the trusted servant, he does what he has to do. And then he leaves. Moshe Rabbeinu to ascend himself goes back, as Rashi says. He pitches his tent and he waits for his master, for Moshe Rabbeinu, his teacher, to return. Good. That's how we understand these psukim. But the commentary that I want to share with you is the commentary of the Ksav Sofer. And the commentary of the Ksav Sofer is extraordinary in the sense that he writes that there's a great significance of the word vayakum. What's vayakum? Kum, from the sherish of the word kum, to get up, to arise, to arose. They arose in the context as they were clearly somewhere else. And they arose to go to the place that is clearly this place of extraordinary significance. The significance of the place that they go and the significance of the word vayakum. Now, we know that this is not the first time that we've seen this word vayakum. It appears many times throughout Tanakh. But the word vayakum comes to us again here in this parsha, Parsha Mishpatim. But it appeared to us at a previous instance in Sefer Bereishis, Perek Chav Gimel Posik Yud Zayin, chapter 23, verse 17. And there, when the word Vayakum is used, it's used in reference to Avram Avinu's purchase of Maris Machpelah and Parshas Chayesar. Of course, you'll remember what is the Posik after Sari Menu's passing. So the Posik tells us Vayakum, and it was that Avram Avinu Vayakum, there's a getting up. Vayakum stay Ephron. And so the field of Ephron, which was Asher b'Machpelah, which was in Machpelah, Asher lifnei Mamre, which is facing Mamre, it was Hasodev Amora Asherbo, it was established in Avram Avinu's possession. And you should know, V'chol ha'etz Asher b'soda Asher b'chol gevulo soviv. It is that this field and the cave that was in it, all of the eights, all the trees that are in the field, which were within its entire border, it's giving us, you know, longitude, latitude. It's giving us coordinates. It's telling us that this is in the possession of Avram Avinu, who's going to bury his recently deceased wife, Maris Machpelah, Chevron, of course, as we all know. But the word, says the Ksav Sofer, that we understand that there's a connection between is this connecting word, or the connecting letter, and the connection that we have. Vayakom Sidei Ephron. Not just kum and yakum, it's vayakum, vayakum stay Ephron, asher b'machpelah. And Rashi there in Parshas Chayesara writes, again, that the word vayakum means something. What does it mean? It means a certain transfer, an elevation of stature. So what does that mean? So Rashi says, vayakum, tekuma haysalah sheyotza miyad hejoit liyad melech. Now, what does this mean? That this wasn't just some business transactional transition from, you know, I'm going to sell you my property and you're going to buy it and I'm going to buy your field and I'm going to buy your land, I'm going to buy your building. It's a transactional activity. So it seems like, why do we need to know about the business dealings? His wife died. He needs to find a place for her to be buried. He finds Maris Machpelah. It's a biblical place. It's Chevron. And so he finds this place and he marries her in Maris Machpelah. It's a business deal. Vayakum stay Ephron. It's in Machpelah. What's his tutzach? What's going on? So Rashi tells us very simply, because there was something that happens here. There's an elevation. There's a status change. Sure, you have that this was a field, but before, while the field was owned by a hedgeot, a commoner, it was in the stay Ephron. Now that it's sold to Avram Avinu, you know what happens? Now it's in the possession of a melech. The possession of a simple person now goes into the possession of a king, of a melech. As Rashi quotes the Medrash Rabbah, Mem Ches Ches. The Medrash tells us that this is what we understand. Pshuto shel mikra v'yokum astev v'amara asher bo v'chol ha'etz l'avrom lemikna, we understand, again, the simple meaning is, and the field and the cave that was within it, and all the trees and all the brushes, it comes in Avraham Avinu's, you know, possession. Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. That's Pashut Pshat. But the Medrash that's quoted by Rashi is something else. Medrash is saying that there's a transition that happens. Vayakum is that there's an elevation that happens. That as the field went from a simple person, now it goes to a melech, a man of royalty, a man of malchus, a man who walks in the way of the Ribono Shel Olam, Avraham Avinu, the Ish Yehudi HaRishon, the first Jew, the one to establish monotheism. So here you have Avraham Avinu. It's not just that there's this transaction that takes place, but that now it's in the possession of an Avraham Avinu. It's extraordinary. You know, when you have a transaction and you have an elevation of a status, you have a synagogue, for example, the shul that you daven in. So maybe before you didn't build your own building yet, but you know, you have a property that once upon a time it was a gym, let's just say, for example, for argument's sake, or it was used for something else. And now you take over that space and that is no longer a gym, but now it's a makom tefillah, it's a makom Torah, it's a makom of aliyah, it's a makom of dveikus and connection to Hashem. You know what's happened? That even though people were sweating and burning calories and lifting weights and running on a treadmill and cardio exercise once upon a time, and now that room has become elevated, the walls of that building, because of what the transition was, and in that purchase of this field, which was simply a field, there was a mountain that was Sinai, Har Sinai. It was simply a mountain that became now Mamad Har Sinai, where the Jewish people received the Halakha Torah. It's a place that it's not just a mountain, it's the mountain. It's not just a room, it's the room. It's not just a field, it's now the field. It's a place that's elevated because of the person or because of the purpose. If the purpose is for tefillah, for dveikus, for connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam, so that place becomes elevated. If the person is of royalty, if the person is of malchus, if the person is an Avraham Avinu, so anybody who has a relationship with that person, it's like their finger is a finger of gold. That person touches whatever it is that they touch. That becomes elevated. Vayakom is here we see Rashi is telling us tekumai salah shiyotza miyad hejot liyad melech, that the field vayakom is coming to tell us this word is that there's this transaction. No, but there's a transition in this transaction, and so therefore we understand it's using this word is used in describing the transfer of ownership of Ramaris Machpelah from Ephron to Avram, because this property underwent an aliyah. It went an elevation, leaves the possession of a wicked, you know, regular person, a simpleton. Ephron is a Rasha. It's now in the possession of a righteous man at Tzadik Avraham Avinu. Now here we understand the connection. Says the Ksav Sofer with this realization of this word where it's used initially in Rashi's understanding. So says the Ksav Sofer, he says that the Torah speaks of Moshe Rabbeinu as well, his ascent to Har Sinai. It's not just that he goes up to the mountain and he experiences this giving of the Torah, and it's not going to influence him. It's going to change him. Every place that a person goes, whether you like it or not, it changes you. You know, the famous metaphor that's used to describe that a person walks, you know, you park your car, you're going to the mall, and you park yourself by a department store. You want to go into the inner sanctuary of the mall. There's stores that you want to go inside the mall, but you have to walk through the department store. Now, usually they have the, you know, the beautification section right at the precipice of how you enter from the mall into the department store. And there's perfume that's usually for sale. And there are volunteers who are spritzing sprays of the perfume. And whether you like it or not, whether you've chosen or otherwise, you're walking past and you're simply going from one place to another place. You want to get to the sporting goods store. You want to get to the shoe store. You want to get to, and into the jewelry store. You want to get wherever you're going to get. And you're walking past, and all of a sudden, the person you're with said, "Wow, you smell like perfume." Says, "Did you buy perfume?" "I didn't buy perfume. I didn't even know that I smell like perfume." "What's the answer?" So the answer is that you smell like it because it was in the air, the waft of the air, the scent, it's in the air. And that sits on a person. It sits on a person, whether you know it or not, where if you enter into a place that's holy, the holiness sits with you. If you enter into a place that's a makom of znus, of promiscuity, a place that's derelict of value, so that becomes who you are. That becomes, it sits on your skin, it sits on your soul. It becomes an influence on you in such a way you might not necessarily even realize to what extent it influences you. So the company of the people that we choose to be around, the choosing of where we go on vacation, the eateries that we go, the recreation that we choose, all of those things are choices that are in our hands and then on our proxy, and that we should certainly choose, you know, but choose well. But these are things we have to realize that have the influence on us. Well, we understand that Moshe Rabbeinu's ascent to Har Sinai to receive the Ribbono Shel Olam's laws, the Torah HaKadosha, is now used with the word Vayakam Moshe VeYehoshua. Why? Because he experiences himself an elevation of his own stature. He becomes a different Moshe Rabbeinu, becomes a greater Moshe Rabbeinu, becomes an elevated Moshe Rabbeinu at that time, because he ascends to the heavens. He hears the Torah directly from God. Obviously, it goes without saying, would that not be? Because obviously, if he's going to go to a Makom Kadosh like this, and he hears from the, how can he possibly be the same? If he hears the words from the Ribbono Shel Olam spoken, he's in this extraordinarily special spiritual ambiance. Not that he's just in a place where it's just like boring, monotonous, uninspired, but it's so extraordinary. So now that he comes down from the mountain, his life will never be the same. His Shabbos Zmiros, his family time, his recreational choices, how he spends his free time, nothing will ever be the same because of this experience that he has, because it's a vayakum. He experiences a vayakum, an elevating that literally is transformative. It makes it that he's a different Moshe Rabbeinu. And as there's a possibility for an ascent, for a rise, for a spiritual achievement, so there is, lo aleinu, unfortunately, also on that same scale, the possibility for what we call a yirida falling, an abysmal failure to just maintain. A person comes to the depths and falls very far. So we understand that the significance of what Moshe Rabbeinu experiences and how the influence of that is meant to be understood. But here's where I want to kind of add to this in a way that I think even is easy to be overlooked, but so important nonetheless. It goes without saying. Obviously, if Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be in the company of the Ribbono Shel Olam, so obviously he's going to be a different Moshe Rabbeinu. There's going to be an influence and elevation. Obviously, it goes without saying, it would be criminal if it wouldn't be that way. So obviously it was. But says the Ksav Sofer, when it says Vayakam Moshe, but it also says Vayakam Moshe V'Yehoshua Misharso. Wait a second. It's one thing if Yehoshua would go up with him, but Rashi already learned didn't go up with him. He only went up to a certain point. He went to a gavul. He went to a border. He went to a boundary. He went to a place and no further. So what's the understanding? Vayakam Moshe V'Yehoshua Misharso. Vayakam Moshe V'Yehoshua Misharso. Vayal Moshe El Har HaElokim. Only Moshe goes. It indicates that Yehoshua also experiences some level of elevation. But what's his elevation? If Moshe Rabbeinu's elevation was that he went upstairs, if you will, up to the heavens, sat by the Kisei HaKavod, receives the Holy Torah, and we understand that Yehoshua did not do that, what's his Vayakam moment? What's his elevation moment? So says, the Ksav Sofer explains, because the greater the master, the greater the teacher, so the more the Eved, the servant, grows. Listen, that's unbelievable. It's worth repeating again. The greater the master, the more the servant grows. You know, when a person excels, when a person rises to greater spiritual heights, so the people under that person's sphere of influence, they rise with him. They're also influenced by them, right? It's not just that the person is elevated. It says my good dear friend, Rabbi Josh Brody, loves to say, and it's all the signatures of his emails, influence yourself, inspire yourself to inspire others. That's the correct quote. Inspire yourself to inspire others. It's true. When you're inspired yourself, when you yourself have elevation, when you have an aliyah, when you are brimming with kedusha and accomplishment, you know what happens? Everyone around you in your sphere, in your circumference, in your Dalet Amos, in your community, in your family, all of those people who are in your sphere of influence, they rise along with you. They could fall with you, but they rise along with you. The influence that you have, the confluence of the consequence of who you have become because of your vayakam, if you're a teacher, if you're a parent, if you're a sibling, if you're a grandparent, certainly if you're a Rebbe, a Mora, a Malamed, so the influence that you have, it's extraordinary. If you take a moment and you read Rabbi David Trank's a book that was put out by Art Scroll, you'll see just love them, the love that he had for his students. It was contagious. It was infectious. It was a love that he had. It was a simcha that he had in his own learning. And it was a simcha that he had for his Talmidim that made it that they were built because of his enthusiasm. He was known to, you know, accept all boys into his yeshiva in Adelphia, New Jersey, because he didn't think that there was a single person that didn't have a possible opportunity to achieve, to be elevated. And that was him. And because he himself was so on fire, so his soul on fire was inspired, so he inspired other people along the way. Vayaka Moshe, it was Vayaka Moshe, and so therefore it was Vayaka Moshe v. Yahushua, that even though Yahushua doesn't actually go, he's able to vicariously, through the accomplishment of the teacher, of his spiritual father, of Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's it. What we understand as a result of Vayaka Moshe, Moshe's elevation is he makes his way to the top of Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, of the mountain Sinai. So his faithful disciple, this Yeshua, was similarly elevated as well. He was uplifted. His life was changed, because how you are and how you live, whether you like it or not, it influences others. The Ksav Sofer here instructs us in a very important way. That very often the most effective way of helping others improve themselves, how other people can become accomplished, is by simply doing one thing and one thing only. And that secret, friends, is the secret of just improving ourselves. When we improve ourselves, when we work on our midos, we work on our attributes, we work on our own loving kindness, we work on our inspirational moments, our ability to daven and connect Hashem, to learn Torah with a hislavus, when we're able to do kind, generous things. So you know what happens? When we ourselves become built and build ourselves up, so vicariously, unknowingly, and I'll tell you, it's even knowingly, you know that that's what's going to happen. Your children are influenced. Your families are influenced. Your communities are influenced. The world is influenced by it. If only people chose to worry less about what other people are doing and to focus more on improving themselves, my goodness, we would be a people, metropolis after metropolis, kehila after kehila, that would be people that would be able to live not only inspired lives ourselves, but by definition, inspire others along the way. And so if we want to positively influence the people around us, there's so much rhetoric and finger pointing and commentary, look at this and look at that, and they should do this and this one should do this, and I should impugn this person and I should impugn that person, and I'm castigating people left, right, and center. No. To stop looking around the people with negativity, there's enough negativity to go around. But if we want to change the world, if we want to make an influence in people's lives, we want to make an influence in the world around us, so we should focus first and foremost on lifting ourselves higher. Make it so that we stand on the proverbial chair. We rise ourselves to the responsibilities that we know that we should live faithfully towards, which will likely have an effect on lifting other people as well. You're going to lift people up with you. Now, the example that we set through our conduct, the example that we set through our lifestyle, it's far more influential in many cases than direct instruction. Do this, say that, think this. That's direct frontal instruction. It works for some. And even if it works for others, not as much, it works very little. What's the best is I want to live like that person. I'm inspired by their love of Torah. I'm inspired by their love of chesed. I'm inspired by their love of people. I'm inspired by their love of humanity. Look at how these people live, and I want to be like that. And so we have to work to elevate ourselves. It's a beautiful lesson of the Ksav Sofer, to always reach higher. And these efforts that we make will just, you know, then impact the people around us, make the world just a little bit better. I remember, and, you know, this kind of point comes to light. Before COVID hit, we were Zocha, we merited the opportunity to welcome among our many scholars and residents that we've welcomed to the Boca Jewish Center community, Rabbi Marvin Heyer from the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And while he was with us for Shabbos, he shared so many extraordinary, beautiful stories. He has so many stories of his encounters and his meetings with people and the bridging of the gaps that exist, because the life work that he's been committed to and continues to be committed to is educating people of the horrors of the Holocaust, the horrors of hatred, unchecked hatred, and what can happen when it relates to understanding how the evils of yesterday can be repeated, lo lein rachmona letzlan, if it isn't that people understand to learn their lessons. So in his book, which I recommend for all to read, so he shares an unbelievable story. And this unbelievable story really highlights, kind of similar to the first story I shared with you this morning, the story of the influence that you can have on somebody, and not necessarily knowing where or how and to what extent the influence can be, you know, ultimately manifest. So he explains in his book that he had the opportunity to meet King Hussein, and he actually had and developed a very close personal relationship with him. And in fact, King Hussein came to the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles and visited him. And he explains that on one occasion, he presented the king from Jordan with a silver shofar as a gift. And this silver shofar inscribed upon the shofar as a gift with the words, and they quote, "He who pursues peace will find his prayers answered." So the king, he accepts the prize. Everybody was there. They give him a rousing standing ovation. And then Rabbi Heyer gets up and he thanks His Royal Highness, comes to the Museum of Tolerance. And in these powerful words, which I want to share with you in a direct excerpt, a direct quote, he reinforces this message. What's the message? Listen to what he says. He said, "A few moments ago, your majesties, you saw firsthand," he was talking to the king and his wife, "you saw firsthand the results of unmitigated hatred when you visited the museum, particularly the Holocaust section that highlights the evil brought upon mankind by the Third Reich. But the story of mankind," and these are the most important words here, "the story of mankind, we are, friends, writing the story of mankind," these are the words that got me, "but the story of mankind need not be written in a crematoria or in death camps. It need not be written in the carnage left by a terrorist attack. It can be written in the fertile fields that feed the hungry, in the wonders of modern medicine that cure the sick. It can be written in the classrooms of our schools, in the classrooms of our universities that help defeat ignorance, or in our synagogues, or in mosques that nourish the soul, and in the halls of our legislatures that protect the rights of free men and women all over." He said, as they sat together at the luncheon afterwards, following the ceremony, so the king innocently turned to Rabbi Heyer and said to him, "I would like to become a member of your museum." Now, Rabbi Heyer said that he just assumed that he was speaking figuratively. "You know, I support what you do. Very powerful day, very inspiring." So Rabbi Heyer said he didn't go into the membership policy, you know, differences of how you can join membership, but King Hussein said, "Is there a membership card that I could fill out?" So realizing it was serious at the time, Rabbi Heyer instructed one of his staff members to run over to the museum's lobby, fetch some of the membership materials. And when he came back, he gave it to the king, who, you have to remember, the king of Jordan is a descendant of the Islamic prophet Muhammad, with a membership card to the Simon Wiesenthal Center, to the Museum of Tolerance. He removes a fine ballpoint pen from his jacket pocket, signs the back of the card and tucked it into his wallet. And now he becomes a member of the Museum of Tolerance, because the influence that you can have on people by extending themselves, by extending yourself, by extending, you know, values to other people, it's extraordinary. And it's in those very words that the story of mankind can be written by our deeds, by the things that we say, by the things that we do, by the values that we live. It's the vav hachibor, it's the vav that's the connector between what was in last week's parsha, what is in our parsha. It's the connection between Moshe Rabbeinu and his disciple of great, great consequence, Yehoshua, his disciple of extraordinary, who becomes now the leader of the Jewish people because of his proximity to Moshe Rabbeinu. It's the vav hachibor that connects us, vayakam, he gets up. And as there's a connection between the property, the field of Ephron, that now becomes the field of Avraham Avinu, becomes elevated, says the Medrash Rabbah. Now there's an elevation of Moshe Rabbeinu, but not just an elevation of Moshe Rabbeinu, there's an elevation of Yehoshua. And Yehoshua is elevated because of the proximity. And friends, when people who are in our proximity, likewise, we become like an Avraham Avinu. Likewise, we become a Moshe Rabbeinu. Likewise, become a Sarah Imenu, and a Rachel Imenu, and a Leah Imenu. Likewise, we become these holy people because we are a repository of holiness, of Kedusha. Likewise, as individuals have had influence on individuals for millennia, we likewise carry the torch, hold that bare responsibility upon our heart and in our soul to be an influence on others, to understand that the world is watching. Your children are watching, your grandchildren are watching, everybody is watching. And so when we live our lives inspired, we inspire others along the way. Let's understand that this is the idea where, yes, mankind's story is written by each and every one of us. A story of a synagogue and a community in Hamilton, Ontario. But it's the story of the Jewish people around the world. And it's the story of humanity for which we are the Shomrim. We are the guardians. We are the ones that are Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kodosh. We are a holy nation, a kingdom of priests, who are meant to espouse not only values in word, but to espouse values in deed as well. We should all be zocha to understand and internalize this very powerful Ksav Sofer and important message in our day. Be uplifted, be duly inspired, be an inspiration for others. Keini yi ratzon v'nomar amen. I thank you all so much for joining us. Those of you who joined us, the Boca Jewish Center Zoom room, love learning with all of you each and every week. And for those of you who have joined us via Facebook Live, I wish everybody a beautiful Thursday, a beautiful Rosh Chodesh. Misha nichnas adar marbin b'simcha tonight, tomorrow on Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Shkolim. We should have simcha in our month, simcha in our months, simcha in our year, simcha in our personal lives, in our familial lives, in our community, for Klal Yisrael, the world over. There should be refuah, there should be healing, there should be peace and tranquility. Yemir Hashem, we should be zochet Yeshua Hashem, clarifying. I wish everybody a beautiful day and a beautiful Shabbos Kodesh.